All right. Welcome to another episode of the pod. Today's guest, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, really needs no introduction, but it's Peter Lee, who's one of my colleagues here at Microsoft, and he's the president of Microsoft Research, and he's focused on steering the company's worldwide network of research labs, incubating breakthroughs, research-powered business on artificial intelligence, computer foundations, health and life sciences, so covering the entire breadth. Before joining Microsoft, Peter headed the Transformational Convergence Technology Office at DARPA and also served as chair of Carnegie Mellon University's Computer Science Department. He's a fellow of the ACM and actually recently elected member of the Mayo Clinic Board of Trustees. And of course, you may know him as well from his very influential book from 2023 called The AI Revolution in Medicine, GPT-4 and Beyond. And then, of course, now the follow-up podcast series, which we will get into today. So welcome, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Or should I say Dr. Lundgren? It's great to be here.
Only part-time now, so that so Justin, I know that you and I have been kind of trying to keep up, as we always do, with the show of like what's the most current event and how are we following some of the trends, and then how does it impact healthcare. I feel like the last few days has been even more frenzied than usual, and I'm hearing that July overall will be crazy. But I think we're kind of recording this around the time of the Grok launch, so I think it's probably the first topic that at least I'm interested in covering. So I don't know if you have some of the latest info.
So I've just pulled up now. They just released their benchmarks. This will be very similar to people who've been listening. New model comes out, more money, more compute, better performance. I'll state just a few other parts. It's amidst a few other things. The CEO has stepped down. There's been some differences on alignment and training and some controversy around the model. We won't dive into that today. But a few of the other things just to go fly through from kind of the data, new model kind of jumping to the top of the benchmarks. This is starting to outcompete, O3 Pro, Gemini, 2.5 Pro, et cetera, on kind of a multimodal benchmark putting together here. And maybe I'll show one more here talking about some of those specific exams, Spark AGI, et cetera. And I know, Matt, actually, you had some extra comments you wanted to cover on this one.
Well, I think this is a great opportunity now that we have Peter with us too. It's just that, I think we talk a lot about like bigger models, larger clusters, maybe even more data, and that's sort of that pre-training world. And I feel like, especially since 01, if not 03, I've kind of, DeepSeek and some others, we really have started to think more about post-training, right, and test time compute. And I don't know how you're seeing this. I think there was that Noam Brown quote from OpenAI who basically said that just a few seconds of letting the model quote unquote think is equivalent to, scaling up by like a couple X. How are you looking at this? And then do you feel like this is yet another opportunity just to continue to infinitely scale at some level to the limits of physics, I suppose? And electricity, right, to get to, that next big breakthrough.
Well, I think for sure, at least for people who are involved in the more research side of the development of these systems, that the hot area and the focus is on post-training and on inference time compute. I think that's where a lot of the thought is going in, because it's getting harder and harder to get breakthroughs and real advances in the pre-training phase. And pre-training also is just high stakes. It's sort of like getting to the point where to have another pre-training run at scale is sort of like making a commitment to, I don't know, a new silicon processor architecture. You can't do too many of those things. And so there's just a lot more flexibility and a lot more opportunity if you are an innovator to try out your ideas in the post-training phase. And so there's just a huge flurry of activity there. One thing though, I think does seem to be, we don't know everything about why these reasoning models are working so well, but one thing that seems to be true is that the the pre-trained model, that base model, has to be very good in order to reliably get good results in these reasoning paradigms.
I feel like it seems like there's so many different paths on the test time compute, but also that I worry that we're chasing benchmarks because I feel like in some cases, like it shows super awesome performance on a lot of these benchmarks. There's that old, like, is it like Godard's law, whatever, where it's, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure, that whole idea, right? Like, I feel like it's now almost, we all are becoming more comfortable with various models, maybe in our daily life. And then we kind of get the vibes, I want to say, or feel, and we know our tasks pretty well. And we get that Ethan Mollick's jagged edge understanding. And then we can sort of say, okay, that one is better because I've used three or others for this exact same task. And, I feel like that is, you'd almost have to wait for the reaction as opposed to overreacting to the benchmarks. But this is pretty promising either way.
Oh yeah, I think it is. Yeah, part of the evaluation problem, of course, is hard because it depends so much on what it is that you want out of these models. But yeah, I think we're getting a better and better sense of this. Out of Microsoft Research, there's a very experimental evaluation approach called ADEL, which actually used ideas from psychometrics to try to evaluate these things. And I think that's different than the current benchmarks that people are using, which are which stress test problem solving ability, logical reasoning, and world knowledge much more directly. But in the end, I think what we want are collaborators. We want things that can work with us. And so the question is, how do you evaluate, like when you hire an intern, how do you evaluate whether you have a good one or not? And so I think we're still trying to figure that out. By
Yeah,
the way,
but
oh, go ahead, Justin. Yeah.
no, I was gonna say, but you kind of know, and there are things you expect your intern to do. Do they retrieve the right data that you ask? Do they follow the instructions well? Are they good at communicating back the results? Are they
Yep.
giving you leverage on your time, which is kind of the ultimate metric that we're shooting for? And I do, love, and I know you spoke with Ethan Mollick as well, who talks a lot about just these concepts. So there are some ways that we talk about it.
Yeah, I think you want someone who's a good listener also, knows when to ask r the right questions, doesn't waste your time with those, knows when to go somewhere else for help. So there are things, there are some things that are still missing. Memory is a big one. You want someone who kind of learns from experience and remembers what you like, what you don't like. There's something called entitlements where if you give permission to use certain kinds of tools, that it knows how to go out, learn how to use those, and use those kinds of things. And so, things are coming along, and I think we're going to see continued breakthroughs as these new capabilities get integrated into the models that we have available to us.
I mean, I think this is a great allegory for, I mean, healthcare, right? Because, like, I mean, I was a part of the, admissions committee for med school. We obviously interviewed residents, and yes, test scores played a role in that. But everyone was always looking for that magic, like, combination of factors that led to phenomenal physicians, and it's just so hard to do with humans. I mean, for a while there was a period of time, I think, Justin, in the it was maybe the early 2000s, where it was like liberal arts majors, but also good MCAT scores. That was the thing, that folks were, and they were kind of moving away from like your typical biology majors. And then everyone was kind of like, where do we have an interesting like philosophy major we can grab, and I don't know if that actually led to any meaningful selection. I mean, there was lots of theories behind it, but there's a similar, I think, effect here where it really is feel and using it and all those things. And to your point, the things that are coming or the things that are being explored around being able to complete a complex task in the way that you want it to without a lot of intervention, I think those are the kinds of bars that I'm looking for personally, because I get more frustrated. Like, so you look at this kind of data, like, this is what folks are really looking to do, and this may require additional post-training work in terms of like literally RL on a job category, like the folks at Thinking Machines, I think are, you know, famously trying to look towards, which is take a given task and actually have folks, you know, sort of think their way through the task. Could that potentially be a path towards a reinforcement learning? And that agent based approach is that it ends up being really good at completing these long tasks without getting off into the ditch, which you get super frustrated. You're like, oh, it's gonna do it. And then like it comes back, you're like, man, I waited for like 20 minutes and it, you know, it totally missed the boat. And I want and you almost want to pause it and stop it, and you can't. Like, there's moments like that. You know it's gonna change, but
Right. Well, Matt, you were involved in that very interesting work on the healthcare agent orchestrator. For people who aren't familiar with that, it's literally an agent that participates in an online tumor board meeting and can facilitate the use of other AI models, but also helps facilitate a meeting in a really interesting way. And I think people who are getting to use that kind of early on, particularly at Stanford, I think are finding it to be surprisingly useful. And there's a framework there that's interesting. But you and I have discussed this, Matt. It is still so limited. For example, as a participant in the meeting, it doesn't have the ability to raise its hand and like butt into the conversation. There's a level of proactiveness. It's a pure ser it's a second-class citizen still today. And as we think about the future of these types of systems and the human-machine collaboration, that obviously where we're at today with that orchestrator agent can't be the endpoint. There's something that I think is going to be much more of, I think, an eventual equal citizen, first-class citizen, in those kinds of settings.
It is really interesting that, you know, we all spend a ton of time looking at the newest research, things that are coming out. Very, very little today is still at the bedside actually delivering care, you know. And, you know, Matt's been following, you know, the AI and radiology side of this for forever. We're just starting to kind of get more and more adoption. And so, you know, what we can prove in a lab is still just so far away from what we actually see in practice.
And it may turn out that, you know, to your point, we have been building like tons of narrow models for a long time. The way my framework has shifted, especially with like to your point, Peter, about having different agents, is now it almost makes it like I can think this 1 + 1 equals 3 to me, because like those narrow models we spend a lot of time on, those are tools now, you know, for a given agent. As long as the like to your point, the super agent has at least enough contextual understanding, knows what I need to get done, understands the intent, and whatever protocol ends up winning the day, looks like MCP or whatever that's going to end up being, can figure out, okay, you're a model that does X. You measure lung nodules. Great. That was part of the thing that you know I was asked to do in my task. I'm going to check that box off, and I'm going to use that model to run that. I mean, I see that kind of coming into view, and then I think we're starting to feel like in terms of the scales where there's the camp that thinks we just need one really super smart model to do it all, and we can debate that. But I also feel like the narrative today, to me, is multiple agents that are more specialized, and overall coming up with a better way to complete a given task. And that, I think you flashed that paper up, Justin. But similar to that MAI work, because can we actually start to look at the comparison between like here's the various tasks, the you know walk me through a diagnosis, and then base model versus multiple models. And it's an interest, especially when you start to put other lenses on it, like, you know, this paper shows, which is like, you could order every test in the world and you'll get the diagnosis. But like, is that economically feasible? No. So like, can we start to look at this more practically? And I think they did a great job with this.
Oh, I think this latest work, and I'm aware of three or four labs at least around the world that are pursuing the same thing. But I think the MAI team here at Microsoft is the first out on this, and internally we refer to this as sequential diagnosis. What's so interesting for people that haven't read the paper. Is the model starts with the simplest of all prompts. You get the presentation of a patient that's literally a one-liner, like, 18-year-old woman presents with a cough and sore throat. Something as very minimal and simple as that. And at that point, the model has to be able to ask questions, has to be smart and economic about doing an exam, ordering labs, perhaps making referrals to other agents or other medical specialists. And there's a penalty for the costs of those things. And so as you start to really delve into this, yes, the AI model itself is interesting, but I think to your point, Matt and Justin, to my mind, what's even more interesting is the evaluation setup for this thing, because it's really having to be a collaborator. It's having to understand the context of medical care, work with other agents, both human and AI, in order to achieve an economically reasonable outcome for the case. And of course, the headline is this thing does four times better, 4.5 times better than human doctors, but that's really not the point. The real point is that starting from that just simple prompt, it's able to proceed with the diagnosis. Now, there's still huge questions, like there's the question of what happens if a totally healthy patient that just needs a cup of tea and needs to go have a
Right.
good, a couple of days of rest, what happens in those situations? And so there's still a lot of work to do, but the evaluation framework, at least right now, appears to be able to accommodate the study of that kind of thing. So I think that's super exciting.
Yeah, and I think this paper's gotten a ton of attention from the media and other places, especially with those headlines. And it's something I think people who don't spend a ton of time focused on AI and healthcare. It's like, oh, but the models won't be able to ask the questions. The models won't be able to follow the ticket. Actually, no, they can, to your
Right.
point of starting with a very simple prompt. Interestingly, though, what you mentioned on the evaluation framework, there's been some discussion too of, well, wait a second, a hospital actually doesn't necessarily want the lowest cost
Right.
path. Is it an issue if we're not ordering the expensive tests? And so it just shows the really interesting point you bring up, which is what we choose for these models to evaluate is just so important to make sure we're kind of getting towards the answers we want. And we won't get into the whole, healthcare economics debate for what happens and the incentives to use AI properly. But the evaluation is just so important.
It's such a good point, Justin. And maybe this is a question for Matt since he's connected with the Nuance business at Microsoft. But there's always been a question, the story that I've told on a podcast not too long ago is during COVID, I had to go see a dermatologist because I had a growth on my left cheek. So I go see the dermatologist, and this clinic happened to be wealthy enough that they had a human scribe in the exam room. And so I get treated, they freeze off the this growth. And a few days later I go online and look at the submitted note, clinical note, and the note basically says that the treatment was necessary because I was unable to wear a COVID mask, which was not really true, but it did allow a code that then achieved, it was upcoding basically. And so I was thinking about this because, at that time, Matt and I and a bunch of others were really hard at work on our medical, no, clinical note-taking applications. And actually it's something we've been working on since 2018. We started a project called Empower MD, which actually resulted in both Dragon Copilot and the Bridge. And I tried to wonder, would our product or our Bridge or Ambience or any of these products do similar kinds of coding? And what is the revenue impact on clinics like that one?
I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that because I think revenue cycle management is a massive space, and I think, where does the ambient note move into that? Like, the proper words in my field and in medical imaging, there are certain things you have to mention, right, in order to, is it a complete, is it a limited, those kinds of things that come up. I think that there are both really optimistic ways to look at this, and then also pessimistic ways. And again, this goes into kind of just the health economic side, but you could go as far as to say into some of the darker areas, like, literally fraud and other things that we know occur that cause a lot of waste and expense to the health system on top of the administrative costs. And so maybe this is another way to say, is the automated approach going to give us a better handle on it, or a better way to audit or monitor that at a system level, as opposed to like these one-offs that are happening, or folks frankly even having to potentially go back and then add these things to the notes post-treatment, which again doesn't necessarily reflect reality in some cases.
Yeah. By the way, this touches on something you brought up earlier about, whether there's one super intelligence, that does it all, or whether there's lots of specialized AI models. Like one obvious next step for something for this sort of ambient listening AI, I think, is some connection to quality measures. The reason I think that that makes sense is there's a business logic there, because quality measures are directly tied to improved revenues for most healthcare delivery organizations. Right now, that's a problem for these ambient tools, because they are pure costs. They're costs that doctors and nurses seem to like. And so I think that's why they're doing surprisingly well in the market right now. But eventually, you would want these things also to improve the kind of cost structures of these places. And so quality measures seems, there's a lot of other interest in prior authorization and referrals and so on, as well as reducing errors, like medication errors or other kind of diagnostic errors. But quality measures seems like the one that just, it would surprise me if there aren't real advances there, and particularly with the receptiveness of organizations like Medicare and Medicaid to these kinds of ideas. And so the question to my mind is whether that ends up being a system of AI agents specialized in different ways, or whether you need some more holistic integrated AI. And I don't know the answer to that question right now, but my instinct has always been the more integrated approach, even though agents and more specialized models seem to be the popular approach at the moment.
I won't have Matt comment on this because I know he's complete, but yes,
Yeah.
I spend my days speaking with health systems across the country, and it's nuance and a bridge that come up on the ambient documentation space. Although I'll say interestingly, Ambience, I'd say
Yes.
another company in this space, they are trying to publish now, by the way, we let you bill more.
Right.
Right. And they actually,
Yes.
is that the macro healthcare outcome, we want to get to? No, of course not. However, they do think that is the kind of early proof point for where we're running with these tools. I agree with you, Peter, I would love if quality were the ultimate metric. It's not really measured, yet, especially with these tools.
Actually,
And
Justin, just I don't want to let go of that point that you're making, because the one thing that's bothered me the most over the last 5 or 8 years in medicine is that both technologists and policymakers, in a good-hearted attempt to improve matters, have tended more often than not to put more burden on providers, more cognitive burden, more effort burden, and more cost burden. So, like, we pushed very hard with the government on the FHIR mandates, the Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, data standard mandates. But so much of the burden of actually making that happen has fallen on the shoulders of providers. And this is a repeating pattern. And techies like me have just blindly done that over and over again. We just think that doctors can just do more and more, nurses can just do more and more. We have to get way smarter about that somehow, and spread the burden in smarter ways. So that's a little bit of a rant, but if there's one thing I've learned in my role here at Microsoft Research over, say, let's say the last 8 years, is that we've got to stop doing
Peter, we encourage rants on this show. That's the theme of
that.
the show. No, but I mean, honestly, though, I think to just to touch on, I think the ambient space is absolutely, on fire right now in terms of in a good way, right? I think that clinicians are saying, and it actually is almost a comment that to reflect what you just said about the burden on providers. If just saving that time is a revolution, like, I mean, physicians are saying they were going to retire and then they're not, like, if that's how sort of low the bar kind of is, which means our healthcare workforce is suffering, right? And there's no question about it. In fact, to the point where, and we've talked about this on the show multiple times, some of the patterns of behavior in the market are sort of like the consumer patterns of behavior. In other words, I'm going to use these models on my phone if I have to, because I know they can save me time. They're saving me time in my personal life. I'm going to find ways that they help me. And then there's this tension, right? Because of the safety and all the issues that we worry about privacy in the health system. And a lot of folks are finding that just a shortcut directly, can I connect the models compliantly, either with FHIR or other interop standards, directly to the EHR? And there have been several versions of this. I mean, this is just an article from one of the Stanford efforts, Chat EHR, which is intimately tied to the work that, sort of we're doing in the multiplayer version of this, which is the work with the healthcare agent orchestrator and more complex workflows. But if you look at the work that they've done here, is essentially, hey, we know it's useful. We're going to put you through training so you at least have an understanding of where things could go wrong and you're aware of that. But nonetheless, we want to make the best available technology directly attached to the clinical systems of record. So, because the other cool thing, though, that's happening, by the way, is in doing this, now they're seeing like the most common use. They're able to say, like, hey, I used Chat EHR yesterday, man. This prompt killed it. Like, I really got a really great prior auth note or whatever it is. And that shared learning is really accelerating too. So, I'm extremely bullish on this. I don't know where this starts to fit in with more specific purpose-built models, like how high up into the product land you need to go versus just being able to provide the latest intelligence directly into the context. Like, I don't know the answer, and I guess.
Well, first off, the Chat EHR work at Stanford has really impressed me, because as you know, Matt, and within Microsoft Research, we've worked for years on in machine learning in order to understand clinical data, and largely unstructured clinical data. And it's harder than it looks to do that. We've had some big wins. I think the first really big win was working with the Providence Health System on their reporting to seven different state cancer registries, which used to involve about three dozen nurses all day gathering the clinical notes and then figuring out how to extract the right information for these seven different registry input forms. It's just a big mess. And across 51 hospitals, that they have in their system, it's a huge, huge mess. And this was pre-generative AI. Huifeng Poon led an effort that actually created operational capability that's actually currently in operation at Providence. But now, I had this funny episode. I was working with what we now know of as GPT-4, but it wasn't released to the public yet. And I wanted to test some things out. And so I was interacting with Huifeng, and I told him that I had just met this new postdoc, at Harvard Medical School, and, just wanted to test his abilities to do certain things. And so we were going back and forth with some ability to read some oncology research papers and answer questions. And yeah, I think Huifeng was really impressed. In fact, there was a funny moment when they disagreed on a certain point in the paper, and they had to agree to disagree. And at some point, Huifeng realized this is not a person, this is an AI. Well, I tell that story because after Huifeng finally got his hands on that experimental GPT-4, he managed to recreate that provenance work in 1 week. And it's sort of a watershed moment, and it didn't solve all the problems, but I think it's that I agree with you, Matt. The potential is so huge. As you know, we're doing a lot with the Cosmos database at Epic, and that's where we're learning a lot of our lessons about what's hard and what's easy, what works and what doesn't work. I think the dream of having a new modality in diagnosis and treatment that is very data driven, where you have the presentation of a patient, some labs, physical exam, other data, and you have one component of your doctoring being, can you summarize 50 patients just like this? Tell me, how they were diagnosed, treated, their outcomes, and let's have a conversation about that. I think, that can be done. And tools like ChatEHR at Stanford are sort of step one, on the 12-step path to get there.
Absolutely. And this really starts to lead into some of the comments that, because, most people know, we've done just, tons of work on NLP and healthcare, like as a field, but MSR, Huifeng and MSR in general really have led a lot of those techniques. And then now sort of saying, because we have all this experience, we know where some of the biggest problems to tackle are and how do we apply the newest intelligence and where does it work? Where does it fall short? I think as you start to look at connecting the intelligence directly in the EHR, this comes up a lot. And I think as I listen to your podcast and sort of how you've revisited some of the predictions in the book around this, I think some themes are starting to emerge. I don't know if you're obviously having a lot of these interviews with luminaries across the spectrum, but I think the folks are kind of making the assumption at this point that if you almost are obligated to at least be double checking with some of these models on various tasks. Like it's almost like it's not just like a nice to have, it's almost mandatory to some extent. And I don't know when that will flip entirely, but I'm curious, like have you started to
Matt,
feel that?
when do you think?
Well, I mean,
What's your bet? Well, we can all go around. So
I'm the
what
most
is
biased guy here. So like in terms of like I'm such a fanboy of some of this stuff, but also realize where the pitfalls are. But I will say like I'm willing to look past some of the faults because I feel as though I have in this mantra in my head that, this is the worst it'll ever be. So I'm just sort of like, okay with that. And so I think it's almost now, right? I mean, honestly, I think we really are at the point where especially just for literacy, to get a feel of it if you haven't. I think that's been my, as you know, my soapbox for a while now.
Yeah, I think I think there's a difference between what is medically best and what that both doctors and patients are ready for. And so I think the now, I agree with you that I think that there would be a benefit, for example, in the reduction of medical errors or misdiagnosis if AI were used much more routinely as a second opinion or second set of eyes. It's just more data, more intelligence applied to things. That would happen right today. Whether doctors and patients would trust that and would go that extra mile, I don't know. But I do agree that I think in just a single digit number of years, at least patients would be alarmed if they found out that their doctors weren't getting the assistance of AI. And so that flip, I think, it is much less than 10 years.
Yeah, I agree with that, Peter. And as I and we've talked about this some before, 5 to 10% of OpenAI queries are medically related. Some of those doctors, some of those patients, it's happening now.
Yeah.
I'll give a number. I'll say 2 years, right? And at least in certain cities, right? Take San Francisco, Silicon Valley, where Matt and I are based. It's a very tech forward population, a lot of early adopters in general. If you the patients are going to come in with significant turns on AI to their doctors. And if the doctors aren't at least capable to have a discussion with those patients about those results and be literate on what's happening, they're going to start to lose trust of their patients. And so, it's going, I think it's going to be forced. And then it'll, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed, right,
I
across
mean,
the
if you think
country.
of Stanford Medicine, I don't know if Stanford Medicine has its own patient portal or if they use MyChart or some blend, but it's inconceivable, say, in that 2 year time frame, Justin, that patients wouldn't be able to have a normal conversation with their chart through the patient portal, whatever it is. It could be an Epic supplied MyChart thing where you have a conversation about things, or it could be a Stanford thing or some blend. But I think that the patient demand will be there, and it's just such a natural thing because everyone is motivated to have patients engage with that portal more. Again, it's an economic driver. And right now, let's face it, if you've just had a surgical procedure and you look at your MyChart, let's say, it's inscrutable to any normal patient. You have no idea what these pathology, results are and so on. And so to be able to ask questions, to have a conversation, explain it to me like, like a person who has no medical knowledge or training, or like I'm 6 years old, whatever it is, and to have the conversation like that, I think is absolutely, it's absolutely inevitable. And I cannot imagine Stanford wouldn't be providing its patients with that capability in that 2 year time frame.
I think, I mean, what you're sort of saying is like, what's the chat EHR equivalent for patients and their, because right, because like the current problem was that doctors were sort of having to go cut and paste into this other place. Patients are doing that, right? They're taking they're cutting and pasting. How do we connect that? And I think it's comp to your point, it's complex. And right now the behavior, as Justin's pointing out, is patients are using it. And you have plenty of anecdotes where they're catching things or they're able to, understand things. We've talked about the information asymmetry that has plagued medicine since the dawn of the field, right? Just how well can explain things to your patient, and be really on a peer level journey together as opposed to this dictating, at them and expecting them just to follow along. I think this is going to be inevitable in the very short term.
Yeah. Since you mentioned, Matt, the podcast series, maybe I can plug that a little bit. Kerry Goldberg, Zach Ohanian, and I wrote a book, and published in March of 2023. We made a whole bunch of guesses about what might happen with generative AI in medicine. But since no one had access to GPT-4 at that time that we published the book, it was all a work of pure speculation, informed speculation, but still speculation. And so 2 years on, the question is, what have we learned? When what's really going on for real? And the threat was we'd have to write another book, which is the last thing I wanted to do. And so agreed instead to do a series of 12 podcasts to talk to people, who've been hands-on out in the field or observing the business aspects of this, cl both clinical and business aspects, as well as technological aspects. And so it's part of the Microsoft Research Podcast series, if people are interested. And Matt, you were, of course, a great guest on this.
As I like we had this conversation before we came on, but it's Our production values is very much not at your level, but no, it's a phenomenal listen. And like I was saying before, I think some of the comments are echoed by different, you have folks from all these different backgrounds, all these different areas of expertise, but the themes are really pretty clear. I think so. It's almost like a reinforcement of some things. A lot of open questions are raised that I think are valid. I think one of the most provocative things, and we can probably wrap with this last topic, but I think it was Zach that talked about how does the field of medicine change with this? Not just that we're going to be using the models and making our lives easier, but does the subspecialist, kind of start to fade, and we go back to having a generalist that has these superpowers with these? I thought that was a very interesting topic because, right, for the last, what, 30 plus years, even in my, I mean, I'm a subspecialist, right? And part of that's the information doubles every 90 days, all the things we know that make it important to know your field, but the amount of knowledge that you can possibly stuff in your head is limited. But the generalist with these tools, I think that was a very interesting comment, and that would literally shift the culture of medicine, even just what folks choose to go into and all kinds of things. I don't know if you had
Yeah,
a take on
I
this.
thought about this, and Zach and I obviously have kind of discussed and debated this a little bit. For me, I always have the problem. I see two opposing arguments here. Historically, technology has only increased the number of medical specialties, not decreased it. And I've said publicly, there have been two times where technology has eliminated specialties. We don't have phrenology anymore, because of all the technologies that have led to the rise of neurology and so on. And we also don't have barbers doing bloodlettings anymore. And there's lots of specialties that are technology, part, at least in part, technology powered. But beyond that, you can't find examples of medical specialties that have disappeared because of advances in technology. In fact, just the opposite. So that's one argument. The other argument, though, is, and in I think Sebastian Bubeck in the podcast made this point. Humans have a hard time coping with a huge amount of knowledge, and so that's one of the likely reasons why we have medical specialties to begin with. You can become an endocrinologist, but it's hard to become an endocrinologist and a nephrologist and a cardiologist and so on. It's just too much for a single human being to cope with. But an AI could, and at least in other fields, we've seen this most vividly in agronomics. You can actually see a benefit to an AI model understanding agriculture in Brazil versus Europe versus the US and being able to essentially triangulate across those different agricultural practices to become a superhuman agronomist. And so the counter argument is it possible that a single AI that can be as good as any human being in, 50 medical specialties. It might then enable general practitioners, human beings, to be general practitioners. And I don't know. I don't know which way it would. In fact, I think I'm less equipped than both you, Justin, and you, Matt, in predicting which way it'll go.
Well, let's I did my own version is I also need more time. I don't have a strong opinion yet, and I know I'm copping out on the answer right now, but I guess maybe it's a push to really think through it and get there soon. But I agree with you. I see good arguments both ways. Does primary care shift solely AI first and care move towards specialties and interventions and doing? Does it shift the opposite and everything gets done by a superpowered primary care physician? I think in some cases we may see both. right? Of like, I think early on, actually, we see both. We see some primary care physicians who take on so much more and really lean into the tools and cover many more patients, much more in depth. And I think we see certain routes in primary care where patients are going to self-diagnose, go to Amazon or something, kind of get what used to be a primary care task done almost in a fully automated way. And so I see both of those things happening, you know, almost immediately. Then the question is kind of how does that perturb the system, which I haven't come to my own conclusion to.
If I could just say, I think it's so important for us to be thinking about these things now, and to be really grappling. And I have tremendous optimism because what I see in the medical world from as a techie is the medical world, and especially leading institutions like Stanford and others, really confronting these things head on. Because another question that's sort of similar is, if we empower every person with this kind of medical superintelligence, will we finally realize the true benefits of early diagnosis and better health and therefore reduce cost and burden on the system? Or will just the opposite happen, where medicine is just always going to be inexact enough that your AI is always going to find things that are wrong with you and is going to now motivate people to be an even bigger burden on an overstressed healthcare system? And again, I think it's very hard to know which way it will go. But what I think I feel good about is that really, really smart people in the field are thinking really hard about these things right now. And we just have to keep pressing on that.
Well, we pulled this up. I didn't go through it before. So this is a friend from Morgan Cheatham, and he wrote and kind of talked about kind of here what you mentioned, the shifting of value where, you know, it's been focused on diagnosis here in the middle, and maybe it'll shift towards diagnosis versus intervention. I think this may be someday, where it goes, but I actually think value is going to shift far to the right. I don't think we're close at all to shifting value upstream towards diagnostic and payment models, even though in theory that's possible from the technology. I think we're really going to shift to the right, which is where we're talking about with changes in coding practices, changes in finding high value patients and procedures, hospitals doing a lot more. So maybe Morgan was just, you know, optimistic from his timeline, but I think we're going to shift a lot to the right, at least as a first step for where this goes.
One thing I like about this chart, though, is I would let me just stick to Microsoft Research, but I think every technology R&D organization is the same. 10 years ago, if a techie researcher thought about medicine, they immediately gravitated to diagnosis. And that's good and that's important, but that is not healthcare and medicine. And so one thing I think that we've gotten smarter about Microsoft Research, but we're far from alone. I think lots and lots of places have gotten smarter, is we're seeing the bigger picture better than we used to. And so, when I see Morgan's chart here, that's what I see, is that we actually understand that there are things like prevention and intervention that could also be helped through technology. And that's actually a major advance for the tech world.
It's the start of the journey. I mean, it really is, right? The diagnostic step. And oftentimes, Justin, I mean, most of the patients I've seen in my career even come with essentially having that diagnosis. And then it's about the decision making, the judgment, and then, you know, the knowledge to make the right decisions later, over time. So anyway, this is more to come here, but yeah, this has been absolutely phenomenal. Thank you, Peter, for sharing your time with us and your insights. And you know, as you know, we try to keep this as a ongoing thread through multiple discussions. And I think this really added a lot to the prior ones. So thank you so much for joining us.
That was really fun, Matt. Thanks. And thanks to you, Justin, for having me.